Blog Talk Radio.
Well, in the midst of an unprecedented cycle of anti-president, anti-Trump, Democratic Party, and also in somewhat in the Republican Party, and demands for impeachment over what exactly is not even clear. For some, it's the idea that Russia was involved in the election, although there appears to be no evidence that that happened so far. Others claim that he was trying to manipulate James Comey before he fired him, and yet, once again, the information that would support that is on a note, a handwritten note that was read over the phone, supposedly read, to the New York Times before they published it. And so a series of rumors, innuendo, in many cases lies, are being put out there, and the upshot is that there's a fury that we have perhaps never seen before for the taking down of a president. And in the midst of all of this, we have Trump who's making an apparently successful trip to Saudi Arabia and Israel, where he sold billions of dollars worth of armaments, got new agreements, is setting up a anti-terrorism center in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia itself gave some pretty heated words against the terrorists. But it goes on and on. Now he's in Israel, and he is making new deals. He's getting concessions from the Israelis on various activities and plans are. And they claim that he is trying to create a peace accord in the Middle East that has never been pulled off before. And I do have a little bit of a few clips from this. But once again, the goal of the left is to either remove Trump from office or so delegitimize him that he is unable to act as a leader and will have to resign. And then they understand that the upshot after that would be that President Pence would take over. And when President Pence takes over, then it's a whole new ball game, and you're not going to have a person who's angry at the establishment, a person who is has a righteous fury against the mistakes of the Americans, and is radically opposed to Obama and his past actions. So, very interesting the times that we're living in. It would appear to me, though, that Trump's base is sticking with him. So they say now that there's a chance to take the House back. But I mean, if you turn all of the TV mainstream media into a propaganda, which was already done long ago, then it's inevitable, of course, that people are going to be affected by that, because the average person is not great at thinking for themselves. And, the same way that people were manipulated through global warming, even people that were reasonably wanted to be known to their friends and their colleagues as people who were cared about the right things. Now, here's a little bit on Trump's trip. Trump in Saudi Arabia: this region should not be a place from which refugees flee, but to which newcomers flock. Great point.
That more than 95% of the victims of terrorism are themselves Muslim. We now face a humanitarian and security disaster in this region that is spreading across the planet. It is a tragedy of epic proportions. No description of the suffering and depravity can begin to capture its full measure. The control of ISIS, if you look at what's happening, Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, Hamas, and so many others, must be counted not only in the number of dead, it also must be counted in generations of vanished dreams. The Middle East is rich with natural beauty, vibrant cultures, and massive amounts of historic treasures. It should increasingly become one of the great global centers of commerce and opportunity. This region should not be a place from which refugees flee, but to which Saudi Arabia is home to the holiest sites in one of the world's great faiths. Each year, millions of Muslims come from around the world to Saudi Arabia to take part in the Hajj. In addition to ancient wonders, this country is also home to modern ones, including soaring achievements in architecture. Egypt was a thriving center of learning and achievement thousands of years before other parts of the world. The wonders of Giza, Luxor, and Alexandria are proud monuments to that ancient heritage. All over the world, people dream of walking through the ruins of Petra in Jordan. Iraq was the cradle of civilization and is a land of natural beauty. And the United Arab Emirates has reached incredible heights with glass and steel and turned earth and water into spectacular works of art. The entire region is at the center of the key shipping lanes of the Suez Canal, the Red Sea, and the Straits of Hormuz. The potential of this region has never, ever been greater. 55% of its population is under the age of 30. Like all young men and women, they seek great futures to build, great national projects to join, and a place for their families to call home. But this untapped...
That is one message there. Here's another one on Islamic extremism that Trump is giving.
Work to be done. That means honestly confronting the crisis of Islamic extremism and the Islamicists and Islamic terror of all kinds. We must.
All right. So he has put out an order to not contain and drive out ISIS, but to destroy them, which you have to wonder why Obama didn't do that. Now, he's calling the war between radical Islam and the West and pretty much anybody else, the Middle East, he's calling it the battle between good and evil, which is a good way to describe it, obviously, because, I mean, there's very few things that ISIS does that is not appear to be pure evil. I will get for you some headlines in just a minute. I think that, you know, I think what people are seeing is that overseas, without the distraction of the constant demand for impeachment, which, I mean, I think each day it happens in retrospect seems more and more ridiculous. People see that Trump is able to interact with foreign leaders, and he was given a very, very gracious and opulent embrace when he came. There were red carpets that were rolled out. Trump did a sword dance, and Melania, she did not wear a veil, and it didn't seem to bother anybody, and she's becoming more and more popular. Here is from his speech, War Against Terrorism, Battle Between Good and Evil.
This is not a battle between different faiths, different sects, or different civilizations. This is a battle between barbaric criminals who seek to obliterate human life and decent people, all in the name of religion. People that want to protect life and want to protect their religion. This is a battle between good and evil. When we see the scenes of destruction in the wake of terror, we see no signs that those murdered were Jewish or Christian, Shia or Sunni. When we look upon the strains of innocent blood soaked into the ancient ground, we cannot see the faith or sect or tribe of the victims. We see only that they were children of God whose deaths are an insult to all that is holy.
Very powerful words, you know. Now, here is a little bit more from this speech. President's speech in Saudi Arabia, the House of Saud. I come to deliver a message of love. Can't imagine that Obama would actually put it in those terms, but here you go.
I stand before you as a representative of the American people to deliver a message of friendship and hope and love. That is why I chose to make my first foreign visit a trip to the heart of the Muslim world, to the nation that serves as custodian of the two holiest sites in the Islamic faith. In my inaugural address to the American people, I pledge to strengthen America's oldest friendships and to build new partnerships in pursuit of peace. I also promise that America will not seek to impose our way of life on others. Outstretch our hands in the spirit of cooperation and trust. Our vision is one of peace, security, and prosperity in this region and all throughout the world. Our goal is a coalition of nations who share the aim of stamping out extremism and providing our children a hopeful future that does honor to God.
Powerful stuff, huh? All right, we'll take a break here and come back and hit our headlines. And little Bruce Hornsby this week. 6:20 on the button, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450. Good morning to you. And it is the 22nd day of May, 523-1450 to call in. And we'll be back to pick up the world headlines. Well, it seems like it would be a big deal. I'm sure it was a big deal, a giant one, in Saudi Arabia, which is one of the world's most repressive regimes, the home of Islam, the home of the site of the two holiest cities, Mecca and Medina, for a woman to not wear a scarf. Probably as big of a deal as you can get in their culture. There are some concerns over the nature of the arms deal, but here's some headlines for you. Trump's flight from Saudi to Israel, the first ever direct flight. Very symbolic. Israel in rare overture to Palestinians at Trump's request. So working on dealing with the Palestinian disaster. Kim.com drops a bomb. The DNC leak to Wiki came from within. So whether it was the guy that was shot in the back who died or somebody else, someone inside of the DNC leaked out, hemorrhaged out a lot of documents. John Podesta, very bitter at Trump. And so, I mean, it was building up to a fever pitch that Trump needed to be impeached. And then it kind of collapsed because there's no substance to it. So here's the problem. It's going to be the issue of the little boy that cried wolf. I mean, if Trump ever does something that's supposedly impeachment worthy, where will they take it? I mean, I think people are so sick of this already. I wonder what segment of the Democrats are already sick of the anti-Trump, you know, to the idea that everything needs to be destroyed up to the country itself to get rid of Trump doesn't make any sense. Is he really that bad? And looking for anything else here that's kind of trending. Trans surgeries surge. Many, many people getting sex changes. So here's the question that I would lay out for you. To what extent are the sexual ideas, including self-identity, affected by the culture as opposed to self-derived. Now, one of the things that you will constantly hear, and I, by the way, I heard another interesting clip from the annals of Dr. Kinsey, that when he was doing his famous sex survey, he dumped most of his data, probably 75% of his data, on the data of the stuff that he published. Some of it was just involving a couple of people. So he had certain ideas that he wanted, certain outcomes that he wanted in the sex study. The sex study then helps launch the sexual revolution, and it has been pain and suffering ever since, as families have fallen apart, as people have continually and more and more become robots of propaganda from the mainstream media and from advertising. And now you've got this wave of people that wants a sex change. Let me ask you this. Take these two people, or take one person and put them in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, whatever, and put them now. Would the same person even think that they were in the wrong body 30 years ago, 20 years ago? Here's another question. After these people get their sex change, they go on hormone regimens, they start dressing differently, they get cosmetic surgery, like Bruce Genital and such, are they more or less satisfied? I would say the science that I've seen says that they're less satisfied. I mean, I think just for one reason, if you're totally obsessed with yourself, then you're probably not going to be a very happy person. And if your idea is that you need to get a sex change so that you can feel better, I mean, I think it's pretty pathetic. I've got a little bit on the arms deal. This might be kind of a liberal clip here, but this is from PBS. An extremely large arm deal, almost $400 billion to Saudi Arabia. Check this out.
Ben Hubbard is in Riyadh covering the visit and joins me now via Skype. Ben, this trip has been billed as an opportunity to reset the American-Saudi relationship. What needs resetting?
Well, I think from the Saudi perspective, there's a lot of things that need resetting. The Saudis, you know, which have been American allies in the Middle East for many, many decades, felt, I think, and you know, we could say that they felt very deceived under President Obama. There was anger over the way that Obama seemed to give up on Hosni Mubarak, another Arab ally during Arab Spring protests. They were very angry at his hesitancy to get involved in the war in Syria. And the Iran deal was a huge blow to them. They very much felt that this president, who's supposed to be one of our great allies, went behind our back and made this deal with one of our enemies. So then after Trump was elected, there's this very much a sense here that this is a guy who understands us. This is a guy that we can do business with. This is somebody that has said all the right things when it comes to things that we care about, which are fighting, you know, terrorist organizations and specifically with confronting Iran.
Ben, let's talk a little more about business. Can you tell me about that $110 billion weapons deal that was struck today?
Yeah, and it could end up being, I think, $350 billion over the next 10 years. They're going to build a number of high-tech helicopters here in the kingdom and other deals that are expected to come through tomorrow, dealing with oil and technology and various other industries.
Ben, has there been any reaction to Mr. Trump's statements that have offended so many Muslims?
What's remarkable, I mean, I've spent a lot of time kind of outside of the area where all the officials are. Yesterday, I went to a Harley-Davidson rally, actually, and, you know, met all these Saudis who love Harley-Davidsons. And it's quite amazing how many Saudis would just tell you how much they love Trump. They're just very excited about him. They feel like this is a guy that we can understand. And you know, you try to push him on these things. But what about all these things that he said about Islam or these things that he said about your country? And they seem much more willing than I think a lot of Americans to just dismiss it as campaign rhetoric, which is very interesting. So, you know, there's been a very concerted media campaign inside the kingdom. And I think it's trickled down. And I think a lot of people have just kind of felt that, like, OK, this is going to be a guy that we can do business with.
Ben, Mr. Trump is slated to give a speech tomorrow. Is there any indication with the tone, the tenor, the content?
No, and it's interesting. This is the one thing that a number of Saudi contacts I have expressed some discomfort over. They've kind of said,
All right, so he already gave his speech, and we know what was in it. It was a good speech. Ricky Skaggs, Bruce Hornsby, Crown of Jewels, 632 Kelly O'Connell AM, Las Cruces AM, 1450, 523, 1450, and we'll be right back. I've got some nice stuff coming up on the notion that is beginning to permeate more levels of the intelligentsia, that the impeachment movement is not just a bad idea, but is ill-founded, is not founded on any substance. We'll be back. But more, a little more on Saudi Arabia, the arms deal. There's some discomfort in the United States and some discomfort in Israel on the idea of building up their war machine to such an unprecedented level.
But she came from the backwoods, bright teeth, stylish hair, good fortune, and everyone smiles, followed her everywhere.
Hey, it's Kelly.
Yes, Kelly. Good morning. This is Deborah. I would like to know if it will be allowed to announce a teaching about the Constitution for 6 weeks at the Agape Christian Church.
Yeah, no problem. Let me put you on hold.
Thank you. Yeah, I got cut off. I called back.
Hold on. You didn't get cut off because I didn't cut you off, but...
Well, maybe I did it.
It'll be a sunny.
Deborah.
Yes.
I don't know what happened, but it went right.
I might have done it accidentally.
No, I don't know what happened, but it just went into some more ads, so hold on.
Okay.
All right, folks, we do have a phone call from Deborah, the dog pooch inspector of all supermarkets. Deborah, you want to let people know there's a Constitution class going on?
Yes, it'll be for 6 weeks starting June 6th. And ask yourself a few questions. What do you know about the U.S. Constitution? Have you ever read it? Should it be a vital part of our government? What is the Las Cruces LSYLP committee interested in it? Come and join us and find the answers.
You didn't say where it was at.
Yes, it's going to be at the Agape Christian Church and also the Baptist Church on Locust in Missouri.
Course. Wait, is the Baptist Church the same as the Agape Center?
No, they're just sponsoring this together. Sponsored by the local
address,
police committee.
Deborah, gird your loins here. Get organized. What's the address of the Agape Center?
Yes, sir, 1400 6th Street. It's part of the Dream Center.
And what is the Dream Center?
It helps, you know, drug addicts, alcoholics. But we do meet there. You know, we rent a room. We have an office. Yes. But it's $15 for adults and $25 per family. You get DVDs. Okay. It's in June and July.
Sounds nice. So
there's a number that you can get with further information.
Pardon
520-7938. That's Donna O'Daniel. 520-7938.
Follow up question: do they allow pets?
Oh, they allow service dogs. Yes, because we have one there that comes all the time.
Thank you very much. Have a good day. All right, folks. A little Constitution class there. And I'm always getting these philippics from these messages from Donna about how I don't understand that America is not a democracy, it's a republic. Donna, you have to have a democracy before it transitions into a republic, FYI. And actually, I was kind of thinking about this. I had read this. I think I mentioned this before, but it's interesting. A big deal to John Locke, who was the kind of the father of the fathers of the Constitution. The founding fathers took an enormous amount almost directly from John Locke when they were putting together the Constitution and the Declaration. But a big deal to John Locke was representative government. If a government was not representative of the will of the people, then it was illegitimate and it could be and had to be removed. There was something else that I had picked up that I think I mentioned this that I got. I think it's the author was a guy by the name of Schaefer. I don't know, probably 100 years old. One of the things that he pointed out is wherever possible, the Israelis would have votes on leadership and on decision making. Find the name of this book for you, but I thought it was kind of interesting. And ancient Israel was a model for Madison when he was putting the Constitution together. So anyway, I'll find the name of this, but it was kind of, I don't know, it was kind of interesting that recurring theme, even from the ancient world, is the best governments have representation. They have federalism as well, not just central command, but representation that is kind of spread throughout the kingdom. Now, here is a little bit on the concerns about the Saudi arms deal from Fox.
The agreement includes the announcement of a $110 billion Saudi-funded defense purchase, and we will be sure to help our Saudi friends to get a good deal from our great American, the greatest anywhere in the world.
The arms transaction intended to bolster national security in Saudi Arabia, as well as the kingdom's ability to combat terrorism. However, it's causing concern for another key U.S. ally, Israel, which also happens to be the president's next stop on his international tour. Israeli cabinet member Yuval Steinitz writing, "Hundreds of millions of dollars in arms deals is something we need to get an explanation for. Saudi Arabia is a hostile country, and we need to ensure Israel's qualitative military edge is maintained." Joining me now is Dr. Ariel Cohen, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and leading expert in Russia, Eurasia, Eastern Europe, and the Middle East policies. Doctor, thanks for being with us.
Pleasure.
This has been described as the largest single arms deal in American history. Why now and why the Saudis?
Well, this is vintage Donald Trump. He thinks big. Just think about this trip that he is on, visiting the key countries of the three Abrahamic, three monotheistic religions. Saudi Arabia, the land of two mosques, Jerusalem for Judaism, and the Vatican. He is building a huge coalition to fight radical Islamist terrorism, and it looks like Saudi Arabia is eagerly jumping on that bandwagon. And in exchange, they're going to buy lots and lots of American arms. In fact, it's not just $100 billion this year. It is additional $350 billion over 10 years, together almost $500 billion,
right,
and a lot of jobs, jobs, jobs. So Trump is bringing bacon back home, looks good, drives attention away from the Russian investigation. So overall, win, win, win.
But creating some choppy waters ahead for the president, because many Israeli officials are voicing concern over this arms deal, calling it troubling. As we heard, one called it Saudi Arabia a hostile country, and saying that the Jewish state needs to maintain a military edge. And now they have this happening not far from their border.
Indeed. And they are the long-term threat if, God forbid, Saudi Arabia ever follows the path of Iran and the regime turns and a new anti-Western, anti-American regime comes to power, all these hundreds of billions of dollars worth of equipment may fall into the wrong hands. So this is something that needs to be on the back of the Saudi officials' mind and of the United States.
It wouldn't be the first time that U.S. arms fell into the wrong hands, but is that something that you see on the horizon? Saudi Arabia?
Not immediately, not at all immediately. In fact, I think what President Trump is doing is trying to put more burden sharing on our Arab allies, saying, you get these people off the street, and as he said, off this planet. So you put more Arab and Islamic ownership on the war on terror. And a very important aspect of this trip is buttressing the coalition against Iran. I was an Iranian leader today, I would be very nervous, because hundreds of billions of dollars of American weapons go to Saudi Arabia, to Qatar, to Bahrain. So he's building this coalition, and then he goes and talks to the Israelis. In fact, I totally understand Israeli concern, but at the same time, the relationship between the Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, and Israel are better than ever before.
President, walking a fine line here between near neighbors who clearly do not love each other.
Yes, but on the other hand, in the Middle East, as in many other places, it's who are you friends against? And today, Israel and the Sunni Arab states are friends against Iran, because Iran is spreading its arch of instability from Tehran to Iraq to Syria to the Mediterranean.
You mentioned the $300 billion over 10 years. The $110 billion up front includes tanks and warships and helicopters and far more. What do you see the Saudis using all this equipment for?
A lot of this equipment is not against ISIS. You don't need a THAAD high-altitude missile defense against ISIS, but you do need it against Iran. So I see this big package mostly aimed at the defense of Saudi Arabia against the Islamic Republic of Iran, but also fighting a war in Yemen, for example. The Saudis are kind of stuck with that. Dr. Cole.
All right. So if you recall, there's the two branches of Islam, the two main branches. There are many, many different types of Islam. But there's the Sunni and the Shia. And the Sunnis are the main Muslims, and they're headquartered in Saudi Arabia. The Shia are headquartered in Iran. And the Shia believe that their view of Islam obviously is correct, but they also believe that there needs to be basically a war started that would have to go through Israel, because they need to take over Jerusalem so that the Al-Mahdi can come and be in charge there. So it's a very strange set of beliefs, in which a third world war basically would have to be launched against all the unbelievers so that a time of paradise can encircle a planet. So Saudi Arabia is not friendly with Iran because of the craziness coming out of there. 6:50, we'll take a break here and come back.
I had a taste for the good life. I had some stars in her eyes. Thought she would have it all. What's her name was in life today.
All right, got some local news or regional news. Planned Parenthood, if you haven't heard this, clinics closing across the United States, including some in New Mexico, three Planned Parenthood locations, according to the Santa Fe New Mexican, and clinics in Albuquerque, Rio Rancho, and Farmington, likely to close by September. Part of a consolidation effort to keep the organization solvent for years to come. And so related to, I believe, the loss of funding from the government. Now, from the Albuquerque Journal, New Mexico, the worst place in the nation to try to find a job. New Mexico and Colorado, first in the nation in unemployment in April. New Mexico, 6.7% unemployment, highest. Colorado's 2.3% rate, lowest. Now, let me ask you this. How is it possible that all of the states surrounding New Mexico, Arizona, Colorado, Texas, are successful, are economically some of the best states in the nation, and we are the worst? We're continually the worst. How is that? That was the same rate, 6.7%, the same as last month. And it's been a year since it's really changed, and that was just briefly. National unemployment rate tumbled to 4.4% now, and solid hiring, according to this article, led to record unemployment rates, record lows in Arkansas, Colorado, and Oregon. States had unemployment rates lower than the national average. Makes sense. Among New Mexico counties, Luna had the highest rate, 17.3%. Lowest was Union County in the Northeast, 3.7%. And so what are we going to do? What can we do? Across the country, nine states saw a significant leap in jobs, led by Texas, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Indiana. It was the only state to decrease, and here we are stuck at the end of the line as always. So I don't know what the story is, but always seems to be the same thing, you know, and I don't know, very discouraging. Here is a little bit of something to make you feel better. Jim Gaffigan, Ribs and Bologna.
You know who seems to be really obsessed with meat are vegetarians. You know, for people that don't like meat, they seem to eat a lot of vegetables that are mashed up and shaped to look like meat.
I find meat repulsive. I'll have a veggie burger with fake bacon, and can you serve it to me dressed like a cow? I don't like meat. I just like to call meat late at night and hang out. Let's drive by Meat's house. Does meat ever ask about me? I don't care. I ain't missing you at all. Missing you.
Never see that the other way. I will have the steak. And can you make it taste like tofu? My wife refuses to eat meat because she feels it's cruel to animals, which, interestingly enough, is the same reason why I don't eat vegetables. I'm a vegetable rights activist. Except for the potato. They can't feel anything. I do love animals. I've never looked at a cow and thought I want to eat that. But once that cow is slaughtered, drained of all its blood, chopped up, and put on a grill, I get hungry. Cow. Definitely helps if it doesn't look like an animal. This ham sandwich doesn't look like a pig to me. But ribs, you know, there's no getting around ribs. Because they're ribs. Amazing how casually we order. Yeah, I will have the baby back ribs. And can you wheel that out in the stroller? I'm going to start with the baby chicken legs. I'm going to have an all-baby meal.
Hey, buddy, I used to be a baby.
How do you eat ribs without looking like a caveman anyway? Excuse me while I tear the flesh from this bone. I need the energy for when I club you later on. I like all kinds of meat, even bologna.
I knew he was white trash.
I don't even know if bologna is a meat. I don't think meat's supposed to catch on fire like that. What's interesting about bologna, it's not just a meat, it's an insult. That's a bunch of bologna. You're full of bologna. It kind of implies bologna makes you lie. I eat bologna all the time. Or maybe I don't.
Maybe that's just the bologna talking.
Have you seen the bologna that has the olives in it? Who's that for? I like my bologna like a martini. With an olive. I'll have the bologna sandwich. Dirty. Everything about bologna is silly. Who decided on the pronunciation of the word bologna? All right, how do you want to pronounce this word? Bologna! I don't know if you saw, there's a G in the word.
I don't see no G. Bologna.
Okay, well, the word does end with an A.
We're going with bologna. Trust me, I came up with Colonel.
All right, so take a break here on the hour and come back and get into a little bit of the continuing ruckus over Trump and anything else you want to talk about. 523-1450-659 AM Las Cruces.
Hey, little Miss Jane, sunny days in a hard rain. Traded in. jumpsuit of pain. Beauty queen and the wallflower feel the same in the darkest hour. All watch as the crown of jewels fall from the old dark tower. She walked down the runway, a crown of jewels she wore. Applause and lights, but at the end of the night, she was the first out the door.
Good morning. Thanks for joining me the 22nd of May. And it is 7:06 a.m. Now, we've been talking about the trip to Saudi Arabia in the first hour and the impact. I think that Trump looked good. 523-1450 if you want to call in, but he looked in command. I mean, one of the things is how people treat you when you show up in their country. And, you know, you might think that Obama was wildly popular in the Middle East because of his seemingly pro-Islam position. He had a Muslim name. I mean, after all, his middle name is Hussein. And he never seemed to criticize Islam itself. If he criticized anything, it might be some of the radicalism. But he really, I can't even remember him going to town over that even. He didn't want to say Islamic, radicals, Islamic terrorism. But one of the things that would keep the other countries in the Middle East from embracing Obama would have been the fact that he sold out Mubarak in a heartbeat. Number one, he supported this idea. And I get this, you're living in a region in which you have a unique and unique says it all, unique and very different than the rest of the world belief system. And you've got some guy in the world's strongest country who says it doesn't matter in the Middle East if a group is trying to overthrow the government, we support those. That's Muslim Spring. And so the places where that happened, it has been a catastrophe. We almost lost Egypt to radicalism, and the army had to take over after a year of pro-Muslim brotherhood leadership. And that person went to jail. Government took over, but then the Egyptians didn't have any love for Americans anymore. And then Libya, another place that we supported the overthrow of the government, is now in the hands of rebels. And Syria is maybe the most obvious example. Syria is just melting down to nothing, and the Democrats act like they didn't cause any of this. And we do have a phone call. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
You can't be serious. This guy sounds like some sort of punch-drunk bozo. He talks like he's got marbles in his mouth. Are you serious? He looks like a buffoon over there.
I assume you're talking about Trump, or are you talking about Obama? Who are we talking about?
Oh, bad try, Kelly. Oh, of course I'm talking about Trump. My goodness, Barack talks in complete sentences. Your boy Trumper can barely get out of third grade English. Don't give me this. Try to compare him to the great BHO.
Frankie, if Obama was so great when he flew to China the last time, why didn't they roll a set of stairs up to the plane?
Because it was in the shop. It's getting repaired.
Oh, gee. You know,
they didn't have a spare one.
You don't think that Obama caused damage for the Middle East, for the world, for the United States in the Middle East?
Nope, the world didn't blow up during his reign, but it's sure going to blow up under Trump. You got that right.
Okay, so
they give them $110 billion worth of arms. Oh, way to go.
Hold on a second. So Syria is better off than it was before Obama showed up?
It didn't get any worse, that's for sure.
All right, you agree on that one. How about Libya? Libya is better off now or before Obama showed up?
Well, I mean, you know, you can argue the point there. I'm just saying, you keep harping, you and the rest of your conservative buddies out there keep saying, I'm a disaster from day one, 4 months into his thing, and it's nothing but a disaster.
If they're talking about impeachment before he even gets into office, how authentic is that movement?
Hey, because I'll tell you what, he was so bad, we're able to determine in advance how bad he is.
Uh-huh.
What do you think of that?
I think it's the prima facie example of bias and prejudice and closed-mindedness.
No, I'll tell you what, there's nothing wrong with that. We are totally biased against evil.
Uh-huh.
He's evil and vicious.
Yeah, uh-huh.
That's right. And also, but I gotta go because I got a dental appointment.
Hey.
I know, you're going to fix my one tooth. Don't get smart.
No.
That's what you're going to say. I got to go to the dentist for one. My
Frankie.
One tooth clean.
Frankie.
Is that what you're going to say?
No, I was going to say have him stick some floss in one ear, run it out the other ear, and you can, you know, kind of get a clean your brain stem.
Well, there's nothing wrong. I got the most. I have a very learned, livable, lovable brain. You know, you conservatives ought to try a learned brain every once in a while.
What restaurant offers that?
What?
Thanks for calling, Frankie. Good luck at the dentist.
Hey, thanks a lot. You take care. I'll call back.
All right. Thanks a lot. All right. Okay. I guess for the Democrats, hatred is a way forward. Now, speaking of which, here's a little bit. Dershowitz. Well, let me give you some Victor David Hansen on the collusion of the Russia story. Check it out.
He says the entire Russia story we've been talking about for months is just such a big lie created by the Democratic Party with the help of a credulous media. Victor Davis Hanson joins us tonight. Professor, you're saying that this whole thing is just nonsense. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think you have to go to the origins and the causes, the methodology and the objectives. I mean, this whole thing started during the nomination process when a never Trump people commissioned a dossier by a retired British agent, the so-called Fusion Christopher Steele dossier that was pretty much ridiculous. Then it was passed on after Trump got the nomination to the Clinton campaign, and then it was forgotten about. And then suddenly when she did what nobody thought she would do and lost, and Robbie Mook's analytics and data didn't prove to be successful, and she didn't go to the blue wall states sufficiently, then all of a sudden the new narrative came, well, the Russians must have done it by the WikiLeaks Trove process. And then this dossier somehow got in the hands of the FBI director, whether he paid for it or not. I think Senator Grassley is investigating that. And now we have this idea that Trump colluded, and this dossier was leaked to media sources, and it was pretty obscene, pretty outrageous, had things in it that could not have been true. And where are we now? We've had the director of national intelligence, James Clapper, said that it didn't exist. We've had Senators Feinstein and Grassley say there was FBI Director Comey said there was not an ongoing investigation. And then it was very unlikely because Donald Trump, he didn't dismantle Eastern European missile defense. He didn't go to Geneva and press a plastic red button. He didn't make fun of Romney for saying Russia was an existential enemy. He didn't have a hot mic exchange with the Russian president saying that he would be more flexible with the Russians after the election. So that entire reset appeasement of Russia came from the Clinton-Obama team, not Donald Trump. And now we're here, and it was very unlikely anyway, because he ran as a Jacksonian who was going to beef up U.S. defenses and get tough with our enemies or adversaries or rivals abroad. So it wouldn't be necessarily logical that Putin would want him to be president. Yet here we are. And I think the real message that we're missing is that there was evidence that some people in the Obama administration had surveilled people, either Trump himself or around Trump, and that information had either been reverse targeted deliberately to find information or incidental. It didn't matter because the names were on mask and then they were leaked to pet reporters. And so for the last 6 months, between this dossier and this surveilling, we've had these illegal leaks. So if Special Investigator Mueller looks at the totality of the so-called Russian collusion dash surveillance story, I think we'll come to conclusions that we don't expect.
What would the, I mean, how ironic would it be, though, if in the course of the investigation, and these investigations go in directions that you can't predict, no one can, that people got in trouble, because that happens with these things, and at the same time, we discovered that at its core, the story was just a lie. It was a nothing burger. There was nothing there. There was no collusion between Putin and Trump. But it still ended up really hurting or bringing down this administration. Is that possible?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, we've had a whole cadre of Washington and New York reporters have done nothing other than for 6 months using all of their tools at their disposal, their genius, their experience to prove that Donald Trump colluded with the Russians. They can't find anything. They haven't spent commiserate time to look at who was unmasking individuals, and that may come out from the House Intelligence Committee. But what we're seeing here, I don't want to be too dramatic, is sort of historically a slow-motion coup where you have a nexus of celebrities, academics, the Democratic and progressive parties, and then you have the media, and they feel that they can delegitimize a president with 1,000 nicks. None of them insignificant in themselves, but they coalesce to build a narrative that Trump is inexperienced, that he's uncouth, that he's crude, that he's reckless. And each day, the point is to drive his popularity down one point until he can't function in Congress because purple state congressional representatives don't want to take the risk to further his initiatives. Meanwhile, the ACA, the tax reform, his appointments, everybody agrees they've been excellent. So there's Trump, the message and the agenda, versus Trump, the demonized president.
You got to wonder if the people who run our news organizations ever think to themselves, it's kind of weird that my priorities align precisely with those of the Democratic Party. Maybe that's corrupt.
I think the Democratic Party is taking its cue from the media. When the media has a narrative, whether it's the use of profanity, the Democratic Party follows.
Oh, of course.
And they've been following the Trump story because the media has been generating it.
That's for sure.
All right. So, I mean, that's one of the elements of propaganda, is to make it seem like a message is a spontaneous eruption. And so if you're not reacting the way that the other people around you are, that means you're not smart enough. You're not in connection with the right facts. And the Democrat or the journalists had this thing called Journalist. It's closed now, but it was a daily briefing that was sent out by just some, I'm trying to remember, he's the guy that started Vox.com. And he would put out these talking points, and then everybody would be saying them at the same time, and it gave a sense of reality that was very false, but it was effective in manipulation. All right, so we'll be back to carry on with this a little bit. 719 AM, Las Cruces, the same, 1450, 523, 1450, on KOBE with Kelly O'Connell.
Hey, a little Miss Jane, sunny days in a hard rain. Tread in your evening gown or a jumpsuit of pain.
Okay, so here is a little bit more. Alan Dershowitz, a brilliant and civil libertarian-minded lawyer and Harvard professor, saying that, and he is a liberal guy, to be honest, but if they do a special counsel with Mueller for Trump's Russia connection, they're not going to find anything. And by the way, this is somebody that has been very critical of Trump.
Congresswoman Maxine Waters have hailed the appointment of a special counsel to investigate Donald Trump's presidential campaign, saying it's the latest step toward his inevitable impeachment. But one of the country's top lawyers is not convinced. Longtime Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz says the special counsel could vindicate Trump rather than bringing about his downfall. Here it is.
Meet the criminal statute. I still sit here as a civil libertarian. I don't want us ever to become what Stalinist Russia became when Stalin was told by Lavrenty Beria, show me the man and I'll find you the crime. What is the crime?
Professor Dershowitz joins us tonight. Professor, I was really struck by this. I don't think of you as a big Trump supporter.
I'm not.
But you asked a question I haven't heard anybody, I know that. You asked a question nobody has asked, which is, what's the crime to which this special counsel is responding? Mm-hmm. What is the answer?
Well, first, I'm here not as a supporter of Donald Trump. I voted for Hillary Clinton very proudly. I'm here as a supporter of civil liberties and construing statutes narrowly as they were written. I just don't see a crime here. I see perhaps some political wrongdoing. I see leaking information on both sides. But even if, for example, the campaign coordinated, which there's no evidence of, but coordinated activities with Russia, and even if Russia and the campaign said, gee, wouldn't it be better if Trump were elected, that's political wrongdoing, but it's just not a crime. Nobody can point me to a statute that would be violated, and a prosecutor is only allowed to look for evidence of a federal crime. And the reason I think Trump may benefit from this is this will be a secret proceeding. Mueller is a very honorable guy, so he's not going to leak anything. And in the end, he's going to find no crime. Maybe he'll issue a report, which in my view would be improper because he only hears half the evidence, only the prosecutor's part of the evidence. But he will say there's no crime. Maybe the worst case scenario for the Trump administration is maybe Flynn gets indicted for lying. The president probably pardons him at that point. But it's 2 years from now or a year and a half from now. And in the meantime, he has a reprieve. If they had appointed an independent investigatory commission, the whole story would come out. And then it would depend on whether it's inculpatory or exculpatory. The public would know. But now it's going to be done in secret behind closed doors. And all we get in the end is no indictment or a lower level former official gets indicted. And I think in the end, that helps the Trump administration, not hurts them.
But I want to get back to your first point, which is that there's no crime even being alleged. So I'm hearing Democrats every night say it's likely that the Trump campaign coordinated with the Russians on the timing of the WikiLeaks dump. If there's no evidence of that, but if that turns out to be true, that's not a crime?
Of course not. Why would that be a crime? It would be like the Washington Post publishing WikiLeaks. As long as the Trump administration or no individual told them to hack the DNA, that would be obviously very different, or gave them information that was useful in hacking the DNA. But just knowing that they hacked the DNA, taking advantage of that fact, it's not a crime.
So this whole I've been doing this almost every night for 6 months, and I'm embarrassed to admit I've never thought about the point that you made, not one time.
And
why
also,
is there then a special counsel?
Well, look
at,
there shouldn't be. Look at the letter. The letter says you should look into the Russian thing and anything that grows out of it. Nobody points to any kind of crime. And there can't be obstruction of justice for the president to fire Comey. That's his constitutional and statutory right to do that. Even if the president did say to Comey, let it go when it comes to Flynn, under the unitary theory of the executive, the president has the right to direct the Justice Department and the right to direct the FBI what to do. Thomas Jefferson told his attorney general to prosecute Aaron Burr. He told him how to do it. He called witnesses, and he, the president, gave them immunity. He called the Chief Justice, who was his cousin, John Marshall, and threatened to have him impeached if he didn't convict Aaron Burr. Aaron Burr got acquitted in the end, but not through any efforts, not through any failure of efforts by Thomas Jefferson. So historically, the president is the head of the executive branch, and he can't be convicted of obstruction of justice for simply performing his constitutional duty. Look, if he tore up a subpoena or erased tapes or put out a perjured testimony, that's very different. But just by exercising his constitutional rights, there's no obstruction of justice here, and I don't see any crime here at all.
Then on what grounds would the acting attorney general have put Mueller in that job?
Oh, I think he did it to protect his own reputation. I think we're seeing a lot of people doing a lot of things to protect their reputation. Starts with Sally Yates. She refuses to defend the travel order to protect her reputation.
Right.
It goes to Mueller, Comey, who wants to have his cake and eat it. He hugs the president, and then he turns against him. We then see that Rothstein, he wants to preserve his reputation. He does what the president tells him to do, write a memo. Now he's turning against him. We're seeing a lot of that going on here today. Reputation protecting, playing it both ways, wanting the president to like you, but then when things turn sour, turning against them.
Amazing. There are about 9 actual civil libertarians left in America, and you are one of them.
Well,
I wish we talked to you earlier.
I'm going to speak out on civil liberties, and sometimes it's going to help Trump, sometimes it's going to hurt him, but I'm there to speak out on behalf of civil liberties. That's more important than politics.
And you heard something similar when you heard Richard Dreyfuss talk about the need for civics to be taught, which is tied into this whole situation. We'll take a break for local news. 729 on the button. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces. 523-1450.
Queen and the wallflowers feel the same in the darkest dark. All watching the crowd of jewels that fall from the over my childhood.
Now we're caught in this struggle. The left seems to think if they can knock out Trump, it will be self-justifying. It'll prove that he was no good. It'll prove that he was a rotten scoundrel, a evil critter, like Frankie says. Is it possible that our old way of politics, which at sometimes was violent, if you just heard about Burr killed Hamilton, if I'm not mistaken. Burr also tried to create his own country. Aaron Burr was believed to be the smartest person to ever graduate from Rutgers. I think that's his claim to fame and being the vice president. He tried to create his own country in the middle of America. And we had the Civil War. So there have been times when passions have flared. But is there anything in our past that would lead to the future, to a resolution? Here's Philip Gorski, a scholar from Yale, talking about his new book, and this is from January 9, 2017, very fascinating, on American Covenant, A History of Civil Religion from the Puritans to the Present, and how it interacts with the modern age, with politics.
We'll talk with Professor Gorski about his new book, American Covenant, A History of Civil Religion from the Puritans to the Present. Welcome, Professor Gorski.
Thank you very much, Marilyn. It's good to be back.
Okay, let's start with an overview of your book. Tell us about it.
The book is an attempt to recover an older tradition within American political culture, one that I think at the moment is sorely needed because it is a middle way between the two fronts and the ongoing culture war.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what led you to write the book?
The idea, the civil religion idea, was introduced into American social science by my doctoral thesis advisor, the late Robert Bella.
Mm-hmm.
And I had read his work as a graduate student, obviously, but hadn't really thought much about it, or for that matter, that much about American politics, since, as you mentioned in the introduction, I really was trained as a Europeanist. But I got interested in it during the 2008 election campaign because I heard echoes of what Bella had described as the civil religious tradition in Barack Obama's political campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And initially set out just to write a kind of a deeper history of Obama's political outlook.
Mm-hmm.
And, as time went on, he kind of faded from being the leading character to just a supporting actor in a larger story in which I tried to trace out an ongoing conversation about the American project that's mm-hmm. been going on since the foundation mm-hmm. of Puritan New England and continues to the present day and hopefully beyond the present day as well.
Okay. When you use the term civil religion, what do you mean by that?
Different people define civil religion in different ways. But the way I would put it is that it is the way in which a particular people thinks about its political project in a larger or in some sense transcendent frame.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't have to be transcendent in the religious sense. It simply has to be transcendent in the sense that it translates the immediate here and now and our particular values and interests,
mm-hmm.
right? So relating our polity, our political project to something larger. In the case of the American civil religion, it draws on two different traditions, or so I argue in the book, that I call prophetic religion and civic republicanism. And what I mean by prophetic religion is the social justice ethic of the Hebrew prophets. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that that the nation is a nation that's under judgment in some sense, not chosen for its virtues, but placed under judgment.
I just have one question for you, and this is something that I don't hear. Just to interrupt this gentleman for a minute. I haven't read his book yet. I just got a copy of it through Kindle. But if the nation is considered historically to be under judgment, meaning that the decisions and actions of the nation will be judged by God, is that why, if that's true, is that why there's been such a recurring rippling out of bad effects from slavery? Slavery created a problem in the beginning. Not everybody in the United States government, the earliest government, wanted slaves. Many of the earliest pastors that came to America were not interested. And so America brought slavery on. And then there was the Civil War, in which maybe 750,000 people died, directly or indirectly. And to this day, the main problem that many people would say in the country is racism. And so are we under a continuing judgment from God over the actions of America?
The idea of civic republic is the idea that the polity is something that's devoted to the common wealth or the common good. That's the literal translation of mm-hmm. the Res Publica, for the Roman term from which we derive the idea of the republic. So in this sense, it's about more than just our own personal self-interest or our own private dreams, mm-hmm. but it's something that transcends those in some sense. And that's what I mean by civil religion.
Okay. In the preface of your book, you write, some common interpretations of our shared past are badly in need of correction. What do you mean by that?
So I contrast civil religion with two other ways of thinking about American democracy. One I refer to as religious nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the idea that America was founded as a Christian nation. And the implication of that is, of course, that somebody who's not a Christian cannot be a full member of the nation. I think that's mistaken. So people who claim that the American founders were Orthodox Christians in the sense in which some contemporary Christians would define that sense, I think is deeply mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
But I also contrast it with what I call radical secularism, which is the idea that the American project was based on Enlightenment values. That is also, I think, mistaken. It's mistaken in the sense that the political tradition that was most important for the American founders was not the Enlightenment tradition of the 18th century, but rather this ancient tradition of civic republicanism, which goes back to England, Italy, all the way to ancient Rome and Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a tradition that the American founders were deeply familiar with. They all read Latin and Greek. They all had read Cicero, for example, who's a central thinker here. And so I think.
So for the, for the Americans, they had picked up this tradition of republicanism that came out of England, and the English Civil War, 1650, is one of the most important events in the history of the world and really laid the foundation for much of what happened in America. And if you understand, if you remember, the first Americans, the first white Americans show up in the early 1600s, so it's contemporaneous with the struggles that were going on in England, including the fight over a national church, the right of people to have a vernacular Bible, a Bible in their own language, so that they can interpret the Bible for themselves, the right of an independent church. And then if you look at the English Civil War, the English Revolution as being a time of extraordinary scholarship, and many, many, many important ideas are spun out around this time. and then see that we are a part of that. And so then we, when we established the country, we established it on the idea of a covenant, and then the covenant begins to get pushed over to the contract theory. But a covenant is different than a contract, and a covenant has a religious element in it, of course. I think it's Brith in Hebrew, but there is in the Old Testament, when there's a covenant made, there's always a blood sacrifice. Some animal is sacrificed, Christ being the ultimate example, his sacrifice on the cross, signaling a new covenant. But the covenant idea between man and God, and then man and government and God, and then God is kind of pushed out, and you have the American covenant. But it starts out with writings like the famous statement that America is to be a city on a hill, that was put in by John Winthrop, the initial governor of Massachusetts. So anyway, take a little break here, and we'll come back and get into this clip a little bit more. I want to throw out something for you guys to think about. Maybe we can talk about it this week. How do we cure what's going on in America right now? I propose to you that the cure is not through modernity. It's not through socialism, Marxism, or the things that were being proposed by the left. I think, and many people on the right don't have an education in this, but I think we need to go back and find out where we came from to find the answer to our dilemma. 744 Kelly O'Connelly, M. Las Cruces, AM 1455-23, 1450. On the 22nd of May, we'll be back to continue this clip. Here's a little bit more of this clip on the civil religion. Civil religion is, it's not evangelicalism, and it's not just one sect, but it tends to be Christian in its expression in the history of America. Other countries, other civilizations have had civil religion. Islam has civil religion to a large extent because it is officially the only true Muslim country is one that mixes in Sharia, the Muslim law, the Muslim belief, and the government. But civil religion on the back of the currency and God we trust, that's an expression of it, et cetera, et cetera. Here's a little bit more from Philip Gorski.
Both of these interpretations are fundamentally mistaken, and that the way that we have to understand the founding values of the United States is a kind of a mix or a hybrid between religious and secular tradition.
Mm-hmm. Okay, in fact, you do argue that we should take the middle of the road. Do you want to elaborate on that and why we should do so?
Well, I argue that the culture wars that have been going on in this country, basically for all of my adult life, are in part driven by a dispute over the proper place of religion in public life,
mm-hmm.
and that debate has been dominated by religious nationalists and radical secularists. Radical secularists arguing that the Constitution mandates a total separation of religion and politics,
mm-hmm.
which it doesn't. The phrase total separation appears nowhere in the Constitution.
Oh, really? And, that's interesting.
Yeah, appears nowhere in the Constitution. The Constitution, in fact, argues for the there shall be no established church, but there shall also be free exercise of religion. And they thereby created a kind of a fundamental tension that's left for us to work out together collectively. I think one can argue that it mandates separation of church and state, but that's not the same thing as separation of religion and politics.
Mm-hmm.
Separation of religion and politics, that means that that people cannot speak in a religious voice in public affairs, even if that is the voice that is
the one that comes most naturally mm-hmm. to them, the one that allows them to articulate their most deeply held values. But I think I'm equally opposed to this idea of the United States is founded on religious nationalism. I mean, one of the most fundamental values in the Constitution is the free exercise of religion, and that also implies the freedom to exercise no religion, to choose no religion.
Mm-hmm.
So central to our understanding of the American project is religious freedom and cultural pluralism, and that's simply something that we have to accept and come to terms with and not try to shout down people who come from a different perspective than we do.
Right. In terms of your interest in the intersection, I'll call it, between religion and politics, we're just coming out of the election where Donald Trump is now the president-elect, and many white evangelicals did come out in support of them. So, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
So I think there's a couple of things that need to be said. The first thing that needs to be said is that some white evangelicals in particular voted for Trump for pragmatic political reasons. They've become singularly focused on what I call the pelvic issues, abortion and gay marriage, and have been angling for decades to get a conservative majority on the Supreme Court, and saw that this was possibly in sight, and that if they lost this election, they would certainly lose that conservative majority on the Supreme Court for generations. So that was certainly prominent in the minds of many Christian evangelicals who may therefore have viewed Trump as the lesser of two evils. The other thing that needs to be said is that there were quite a few very thoughtful and well-known Christian evangelical intellectuals who came out very forcefully, very early against Trump. And I will simply point to two of them, Russell Moore, who's an official for the Southern Baptist Convention, and Peter Wehner, who wrote a number of a very impassioned anti-Trump editorials in the New York Times that some of the listeners may have seen. But this still leaves us with a puzzle. The fact is that many American evangelicals expressed support for Trump even before he was the only man standing.
Mm-hmm.
That is, when people like Jeb Bush and Ted Cruz, who have very good evangelical bona fides, were still very much in the race. And that is a puzzle that I think I can shed some light on,
mm-hmm.
In the sense that the kind of American exceptionalism, the kind of religious nationalism that some Christian evangelicals, not all, but some embrace, has some strange resonances with Donald Trump's worldview. I'll just point to a couple here. One is apocalypticism. That is the idea that the world is going to end imminently, and that the end of the world is presaged by different kinds of natural disasters, by moral decline. Of course, there's nobody who used the word disaster more often during the campaign than Donald Trump.
Let's take a break here. It's about halfway through the clip, and we don't have enough time to finish it, so we can finish it tomorrow if you find it interesting. I want to bring up one term for you, Erastianism. When these people want to bring in, and this was associated a little bit with Cruz. This guy here is talking about, on one side, religious radicals, far right religious radicals, and then on the far left, these kind of radical atheists. And I think the religious radicals rise up because they feel like their worldview is getting stomped out by the state. But Erastianism is a doctrine tied to Thomas Erastus, that claimed that the state was over the church. And, you know, I think it's important, and the state is over the church, therefore the state's duty to enforce the religion is noted. And that's what a lot of these groups, Dominion Theology and such, that's a very dangerous position. On the other hand, if you're doing things to stop religious expression in the country, that's not only against our history, but it's a very dangerous thing, because in history you see when people get rid of religion in the name of the state, then that's when there's nothing to restrain the state anymore, and then just the free-for-all killing happens. We'll take a little break here and be right back. 755 Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, 523-1450. And we do have a call. Thanks for the call. The Kelly O'Connell Show is this.
This is David. How are you, Kelly?
Hey, David. Good, good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Hey, I was listening to your crazy guy that called in earlier, Frankie or something like that.
Frankie.
He just cannot believe how corrupt his own party is when, Clinton accepts all this money from the Russians for giving them a bunch of uranium, and then all of a sudden, mysteriously, billions of dollars arrive in Iran in the guise of night on a bunch of private jets. And then he sits and goes back and forth on a hot mic with Putin talking about, let the election settle down, and then maybe we can talk after that, and I'll be a lot more flexible and we'll be able to get some things done. So I was thinking that what Freddie needs to do today, instead of going to get his tooth fixed, he should go to Planned Parenthood and get a lobotomy.
I don't think that's part of reproductive services, but maybe it should be.
Well, in his case, I think it would be.
Well, poor guy. I mean, I just think that the left is struggling to survive. And what they've always done in history is to use the law, use propaganda, manipulation, use the law to get control, change the laws, and then say to people, this is reality, and we're not going to take it anymore.
Well, they lie to people. It's amazing how all the media does is lie now. Nothing that comes out of the media's mouth it's so hard to find anything truth in what the media says. They make up numbers, they make up stuff, and they just figure, if I pound this number hard enough and long enough,
the great life theory. The great life theory of Marxist. It. Yeah, you tell a lie enough, it'll get traction. But the fact of the matter is, if you have a restaurant and you use it to poison your enemies, when people come in, you put in a food poisoning in their food, you're going to destroy your brand. And that's what the Democrats are doing. I'm out of time, David. Thanks for the call.
Okay.
Have a great day. All right, folks, we'll take you out of here. Be back in 22 hours. Kelly O'Connell, thanks for tuning in. Really enjoyed hanging out with you. Ciao.
I don't know any kind of accident, and it was